Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
Hey, everybody, this is Tom Salemi. Welcome back to OIS Podcast number 202. We're going to talk a little bit about OIS at SECO coming up on February 21st in New Orleans. We spoke today with Chris Roten. Chris is an optometrist from the Bon Roten Eye Clinic in Louisiana. But more to the point, he's on the education committee at SECO, and he's been working with our great OIS staff, including Danielle Silver, on the very first OIS at SECO. We're very excited about this new event, and Chris shares in that excitement, and we get into that later in the podcast. We start off the podcast, as I do normally, talking a bit about his career. He took an interesting path into optometry. Talked a bit about the challenges, both personal and professional, of optometry, and the benefits of getting involved in the optometry community. Finally, again, Chris talks about the technology coming into the field and the benefits of OIS at SECO. So I hope you will enjoy this podcast. I'm certain you will. And I hope you will join us at OIS at SECO. Again, it's happening on February 21st in New Orleans. Now let's get into this conversation with Chris Roten of the Bon Roten Eye Clinic. Well, Chris Roten, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here with you.
So we're excited about OIS at SECO event coming up in February in New Orleans, which is, I believe, in your neighborhood. And wanted to talk a bit about your thoughts and your hopes for this first OIS. But before we get into that, I just wanted to get a little more about your background and how you found your way into optometry. Doing a quick bit of background work, it seems that prior to this, you were working at Exxon as an engineer. How did that transition into being an optometrist?
It's a great question. Certainly was a little bit of a circuitous route for me to get to optometry. I'm very nearsighted, so I was in and out of my optometrist's office ever since I was in grade school. So I had some experience and exposure to the profession then. I chose to follow my dad's career and got a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from Louisiana State University, and had a great job opportunity in my hometown of Baton Rouge with what was then Exxon Chemical. And so I took that position and worked there for 2 years and just realized, you know, that's not really what I wanted to do. I really enjoyed the biological sciences more. And so I elected to go back and make a career change. I was unmarried at the time, so really didn't have to worry about anybody else other than myself. So made that decision. I had to resign at Exxon and actually took a position as a high school chemistry teacher and as an assistant high school basketball coach for my former basketball coach, who was now at a larger school in Baton Rouge, and had a blast there and happened to walk into a situation where the team was extremely talented. I had nothing to do with it, but was just living vicariously through them. But we actually were ranked fourth in the nation by USA Today my last year there, and we probably weren't the fourth best team in the country, but needless to say, we were really, really good. So I got to sit in on some recruiting visits with some of the biggest names in college coaching at the time, and we played all over the country in tournaments and things and had some success. And then ultimately finished my prerequisites and applied for optometry school and was accepted. And, you know, it's certainly, I found my niche and my role and my calling, what I was designed to do, I guess you can say. I love going to work every day and interacting with patients, trying to maximize their vision, keep their eye health as maximal as we can, mm-hmm. and really impact quality of life from a lot of different areas and a lot of different ways that we get to do in the office every day. So,
what sort of tipped the scales for you? When did you know that you wanted to make a shift? Because that's a big decision to make, even for a young person who's not married and unencumbered. You kind of get on a path, and it's sometimes hard to get off it.
No doubt. It was not a decision that was made lightly. That's for sure. There were some economic considerations, you know, after having been out of school for a while and having a decent income, and then having to go back to the frugal lifestyle of the student and that type of thing, and moving to a city I'd never lived in before in Memphis, Tennessee, and saw the Southern College of Optometry. It was very much a family situation there that made it a little easier for me. But I guess as I was going through my engineering career and mainly dealing with numbers and chemicals and things, I missed the interaction with people. Mm-hmm. And I guess we all go through different phases of our life and trying to find where our niche is. And it just really was driven home to me. I enjoyed the biological sciences more than the non-biological sciences, and the opportunity to interact with patients on a daily basis was something that I found very appealing. And as I had an opportunity to work in shadow some doctors of optometry, it really, really drove home to me the impact that I could have on someone's life. As I thought about my own doctor and the impact he had on me as an athlete, very nearsighted, self-conscious, didn't like the thick glasses that I had to wear, and the opportunity to be fitting contact lenses then, and just see the amazing impact that my doctor of optometry had on me and my quality of life and my ability to participate in athletics, and you know, the impact it had on my self-esteem, being able to wear contact lenses and see and not have to have glasses. That's, you know, just a small piece of it. But certainly that was something that it was always in the back of my mind, mm-hmm. even as I had chosen engineering as a field. And as I got into it, just realized, you know, this is probably not something I want to do for the rest of my life. And I do want to be able to make more of a difference day to day in interacting with people. And so that was the biggest draw. And it has certainly been a tremendous decision for me.
How do you draw on that experience as a patient now that you're the physician? Do you hearken back to those days, and when you're dealing with a shy kid or a self-conscious kid, do you tap into those feelings that you had 20, 30 years ago?
No doubt about it. It's easy when we're in clinic every day and dealing with vision and whatnot to sometimes forget the impact that, you know, the ability to see and see well and have comfortable eyes, comfortable vision, and, you know, the impact that it makes outside of our offices, because we usually don't get exposed to that. And so it's easy to forget, you know, the impact we can have prescribing that first pair of glasses on a young student who's been struggling in school. And it's because maybe they're not able to see the board as well as they have, or maybe they have a binocular vision disorder that's affecting their ability to read and process the information that they see clearly and comfortably. And so much information goes through the eyes and the visual system in school now, even more so than ever, with the social media aspect and the online components that schools are adopting in the curricula, that we really do have a unique opportunity to impact the quality of life and the academic success that students have. And then when that, you know, young child who was fitting their first pair of glasses at maybe 8, 9, or 10 gets a little older and they're responsible enough to do contact lenses, mm-hmm. you know, the impact it can have on athletics and just their self-image, self-esteem. So many that need glasses are very self-conscious of them. Not all, but certainly many are these days. And so the opportunity to provide them that vision, expand their field of view, and get the frames and lenses sometimes off of the eyes so that they can do other things that they want to do can really be tremendous. And, you know, it extends all the way up into presbyopia and patient in their 40s who's beginning to have a hard time seeing up close and their arms aren't long enough. And, you know, the ability for us to help them function at work still. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't even get to the medical side of eye care that we can impact and prevent loss of vision down the road in conditions like glaucoma and whatnot. So it is something I really try to keep foremost in my mind as far as the impact that I can have outside of the exam room on a patient.
Hey everyone, Tom here. If you're anything like me, you're sick of me talking about OIS. I'm going to hand the microphone over to Dr. Elizabeth Yu, one of our rising stars. We interviewed her at OIS at AAO, and I asked her why she attended OIS. Let's have a listen.
There is an aspirational component about coming to OIS for the ophthalmologist. Reason being, ultimately, what we do is really for the betterment of our patients. And knowing what is in the pipeline so that we can better serve our patients and understand, hey, you know, this is what is to come out, and understanding where we are going, you know, between artificial intelligence or gene therapy and different drug delivery devices, all this is affecting us. Robotics is going to be a reality. And to know that firsthand and to see exactly the actual scope and time horizon that provides us, you know, this relevant information that then helps us clinically translate to better care, you know, now and into the near future.
All right. Well, thanks for those kind words, Elizabeth. So if you are a physician, an optometrist, or ophthalmologist, and you haven't been to OIS yet, take Elizabeth Yu's word for it. Please do join us. Don't forget the newest one is coming up on February 21st, OIS at CECO. Now let's get back into this conversation with Chris Roten. Well, you've hit upon a couple of touch points in my life. My 13-year-old just got contact lenses, and he does seem a few inches taller now that he's wearing those. It's pretty remarkable, the transition. And I, unfortunately, my arm is not long enough for the reading I need to do now. So I'm dealing on the other end of things. I'm curious, though. You graduated, gotcha. You graduated from Southern College of Optometry in 2002, and then you completed your residency at the Memphis VA Medical Center. This was in 2002, the 2000s, obviously. What sort of activity did you see there? Did you see a lot of troops returning from action? Were you dealing more with an older population? What were your patients like at the VA?
Well, certainly in the VA at that time, it was mainly older patients. We did not have a lot coming back yet from right after 9/11. I was actually doing an internship at the VA actually, on 9/11. I can remember that day very vividly there, and it was certainly a unique and very patriotic reaction from many of our patients that day who were in the waiting room watching the news footage. And of course, took a while to figure out exactly what was going on. But most of the patients that we were seeing were certainly senior citizens who were retired from the military, had served years earlier, active duty perhaps in World War II, still Vietnam, and some of the other conflicts overseas, or had made a career in the military and were eligible for full VA benefits. And so lots of cataracts, lots of glaucoma, lots of macular degeneration, heavy on the medical side for sure. And just seeing the so many of those who had made major sacrifices on behalf of our country, mm-hmm. who are now struggling with eye health issues and vision issues that were fortunately fixable and we could have some impact on. And so I took my time at the VA was wonderful for me. And I have it's a very, very special time in my career, that year that I got to spend there in Memphis at the VA hospital. And it certainly carried over into private practice, like I'm in now. The things I learned, the ability to participate in a larger healthcare system within the VA there, and ordering an MRI and sending that patient down the road, and then being able to review and help interpret those results in real time almost, interacting with that patient's primary care provider who's got diabetes, and we're seeing diabetic changes in the retina, and letting him know what's going on and what we're seeing and how we may need to get a little more aggressive potentially with our blood glucose control as a result of what we're seeing in the back of the eye. And so that was just invaluable to me as far as learning how to interact with other healthcare professions outside of just eye care providers, and the ability to really have confidence in diagnosing and treating and dealing with patients who have a lot going on the medical side of eye care.
And what ultimately brought you back to Louisiana? You had set up practice in Tennessee, correct?
I was fortunate to be presented with an opportunity to join an existing group practice in the Memphis area, West Tennessee Eye, and a couple of the doctors there, Dr. David Talley and Dr. Chris Cooper, were great mentors to me. And my wife and I thought at the time we would probably make the Memphis area our home. We really enjoyed it there and had begun to lay down some roots. And then we had our daughter, and my parents had some health issues back home. And her parents were back in Baton Rouge as well. And so it was more of a family move than anything else, just to get a little closer to my parents. I'm the oldest child and just kind of wanted to be there to help take care of them and my wife caring for her parents as well. So it was more of a family move than anything. But walked into a situation where I had met who would future become my partner, Hunter Bond, and he had a thriving practice in Amite, Louisiana, and in Denham Springs, and was looking to open a third practice in Hammond, Louisiana, and he needed someone to come and help run it. It was going to be a surgery center offering LASIK and some other surgical procedures on site, and just the timing was right. It was Providence, and I was able to join the practice in 2005. We moved back here about 30 days before Hurricane Katrina hit the New Orleans area, and that practice is added to the the overall, the other two practices that were already in existence, it's been able to grow and as well. And we've expanded and hired numerous doctors since then. So it's really been a neat opportunity and a privilege for me to be part of what's now the Bond Road and Eye Clinics.
That's terrific. And you mentioned Katrina, or moving there just after, just before Katrina hit or just after Katrina hit, you returned?
It was about a month before.
A month before, my goodness. And I understand, just again, doing some research on the old Google, that you had some experience with the hurricane in 2016 that hit your home directly.
We were actually the victims of a flood. It actually ended up not being a named storm. There was a system that was circulating just off the coast of Louisiana and in the Gulf of Mexico, and it made landfall just under maximum sustained winds to have a name attached to it. But there was a high pressure system coming out of the Midwest that camped over Arkansas, northern Louisiana, and southern Mississippi, and kept this system just circulating right over our main office.
Wow.
And we had about 31.5 inches of rain in about a 17-hour period. And it just was three times more than was forecast. And of course, the waterways here weren't able to sustain that. So we ended up, unfortunately, getting flooded at home and in our office with about 3 feet of water for a couple of days. And so it was a long road to recovery. But I cannot thank our optometry family enough. Our so many friends in organized optometry at CECO and our state association just really banded together. They helped us, you know, do the demo on our home and rebuild and gave us cash donations that we certainly never saw coming. And we were able to rebuild as a result of that. And it certainly was a big deal. And, you know, the Houston area and Florida last year dealt with very similar types of issues. And then even this year up in North Carolina as well. So we're certainly seeing some major flooding in areas that maybe aren't used to it. And it's amazing the impact that can have, not only on our practices and our personal homes, but even on the community. Even though we were able to rebuild our office and get the doors back open in 4 months, which was no small feat in and of itself, you know, the community wasn't ready to come back. They were all dealing with their own issues. There were 150,000 structures that flooded in our area. And, so there was a lot of impact that went beyond just the physical as well. So we were fortunate to have the two other offices that were unaffected, and we were able to move resources and doctors there. And many of our patients were willing to travel a little bit to see us in our other office locations. And so we were very fortunate. We didn't have to have any layoffs, and we, you know, kept everyone employed.
Wow.
And were able to keep the doors open and not miss any payments and whatnot. So it was definitely a challenging year there, but we've managed to overcome that. And we certainly wish nothing but the best for our colleagues in Houston and Southern Florida from last year, and those in North Carolina and South Carolina that are dealing with it this year.
That's remarkable. It's amazing that you have got that community behind you. But you're involved heavily in optometric associations. Is this something that you feel like you needed to do to give to this community, to be part of leadership? I mentioned at the top, you're on the educational committee at CECO. What is it that drives you to be involved in these organizations?
Well, I guess it was kind of drilled into my head very early on in my career, the importance of getting involved and giving back. And it's certainly nice. I've had some opportunities to work on a number of different committees and then been asked to serve in different roles on boards within optometry, our state association, and those are all things I've really enjoyed the opportunity to get to know my colleagues through those venues and through those various avenues. And I've made some just tremendous friends all over the country. And our profession is very giving and very open. It's very much a family. And you know, I never would have thought that those relationships that I was building would one day help me keep my practice open and help me rebuild my home. But as a result of those relationships, those were some of the fringe benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned so much over the years from those who are involved in leadership in a number of different committees I've gotten to serve on and various boards within optometry. I mean, those typically are the leaders of the profession who are on the front edge, the cutting edge of what's going on, and whether that's how to run a practice more efficiently or how to, you know, find employees that are really passionate about what you do or what the latest and greatest treatments and technologies are. So much of that I've learned as an ancillary benefit of serving on these boards and you know, coupled with the opportunity to really help make a difference and maybe make things a little bit better for the next generation is really something that's always excited me.
Well, how is the let's take a look. We're talking about the OIS at CECO, which is happening on February 21st in New Orleans. Let's talk a bit about how the field has changed since you've started practicing. You, as I mentioned earlier, you started around in the early 2000s, so it's been a good 15 plus years. How has the practice of optometry changed, and what new technologies have really impacted the way you care for patients?
There's no doubt when I was in school and even doing my residency, OCT, optical coherence tomography, had not really even become mainstream yet. And so, you know, OCT in and of itself has really expanded our ability to see what's going on in layers of the retina and in the optic nerve and in the macula, you know, ways that we couldn't before. In my training, we were doing lots of intravenous fluorescein angiography and interpreting those results, you know, at the VA and determining what was going on with macular degeneration patients and those with macular edema from diabetic retinopathy and other conditions. And yet we were still very limited in what we could do to fix it on the ophthalmology side. So we could send our patients out who had wet advanced age-related macular degeneration or who had macular edema from these ocular diseases. And yet at the time, our treatments were largely just laser-based, which was very much a let's just destroy and sacrifice some tissue to save some other areas. And outcomes were very hit or miss. And so with the advent of OCT, and especially now with OCT angiography, which new studies even in the last few weeks have shown might even have the potential to help diagnose glaucoma. So not just an OCT looking at the optic nerve, but an OCT actually looking at individual erythrocytes, red blood cells flowing through the vasculature of the retina, not the optic nerve, but the retina itself can be useful in diagnosing glaucoma and in diagnosing multiple sclerosis and in diagnosing Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. So other neurologic conditions, which we may actually be seeing some biomarkers in the retina and in the optic nerve and, you know, the ability to use the eye literally as a window to the soul to see what's going on elsewhere in some disease states that aren't traditional things we would associate with an eye exam. And so as OCT angiography continues to become more mainstream and swept source OCT, which was just FDA approved this year as well, begins to become more, you know, clinically adoptable as far as the price and the options that are there, I think we'll see the ability to view things in the retina that we've never seen before and in ways that we haven't in the past. So that certainly has been a major shift already just within optometry since I started school. You know, our ability to do a few more things than we have in the past is also grown as scope of practice has expanded in a number of different states, including here in Louisiana and elsewhere. So our ability to prescribe more medications and more procedures that we can do that can really, really impact a patient's quality of life and help them heal better, help their eyes stay more comfortable, ensure that their vision is protected. And, you know, the advent of you know, intravitreal injections on the ophthalmology side of things, which, you know, again, in the past, we only could do lasers. It was PDT and focal laser grids when I was in school and in my residency at the VA. And now we don't have to be as invasive. We don't have to have as much collateral damage. We can be much more specific in what we treat and how we treat it so that outcomes are enhanced and quality of life is improved. And as we continue to see more and more advancements in the areas of nanotechnology and nano manufacturing, even on the pharmaceutical side of things, there'll be better drugs that require lower concentrations because the molecules are made so small that they can penetrate much further into the tissue of the eye and into the retina better than anything we've ever had before. And so, again, we'll have fewer side effects. And so it'll take maybe less doses of medication, less concentrations, we'll have less side effects, and we'll still get better outcomes than ever before. And we're on the cusp of seeing a lot of those things come out. Some of the very first nano drugs have been FDA approved here, and they might not be truly down in nano sized yet, but they're certainly micro particles this year, with Sustained Complete coming out and the new version of cyclosporine that was just FDA approved, Sequa from Sun Pharmaceuticals, all of which are much, much smaller active ingredient molecules than we've ever had available before. We should really see improved outcomes with patients.
How do you see these technologies changing your practice going forward? I mean, you're talking about, you know, potentially not only expanding what you can do in eye care, but as you said, interacting with other diseases and identifying other diseases, and I guess interacting with those specialists if you see something that needs to be identified. So, how do you see optometry changing, rather, in the next 5 or 10 years? It sounds like it's going to be a sizable shift.
I definitely think it will. You know, the number and supply of ophthalmologists is not forecast to increase for the foreseeable future. So the number of ophthalmology residencies is flat, and there's no plan to increase those. And yet we're seeing the population continue to age. And so there's going to be a gap in the ability to provide some eye care services that were traditionally provided for in the past by ophthalmology. And ophthalmology, I think, is going to be definitely busier than ever in the OR, taking care of more and more cataracts and other procedures with macular degeneration than ever before. And so I think there's going to be an even greater need on the primary and even secondary care side of things in eye care for optometry, provided we're willing to step in and fill that gap and prescribe some of these medications and get more actively involved in diagnosing and treating and interacting with a patient's primary care provider and neurologists and just a whole host, endocrinology, just a whole host of specialized fields within medicine, where we really can have a big impact, not only on a patient's eye health, but their overall systemic health as well. You know, there's numerous technologies that are out now that can diagnose a patient with diabetes sooner than the current gold standard of a blood draw on a fasting plasma glucose. There's a technology that exposes the lens of the eye to certain wavelengths and it autofluoresces. And based on the amount of autofluorescence that's recorded, you can correlate that to a patient's risk for developing type 2 diabetes. And that test is just as sensitive and it's more sensitive and specific even than the current gold standard. And so, you know, it's not been adopted widely yet just because it's so new and novel, but I think that's just one example of many of potentially new diagnostic tools that will be out there, in addition to what we mentioned with OCT angiography earlier, that may actually allow earlier and less invasive diagnoses than ever before of some of these other systemic conditions.
So I know you've been helpful in helping us develop OIS at SECO. Why do you think this event is necessary? And what do you say to other optometrists who are wondering whether it's something they should be attending and being part of?
I am so excited about OIS at SECO. Not only is this going to be a little bit of a new venue for us in New Orleans for the first time in decades, we'll be out of Atlanta. So there'll be a lot going on, Mardi Gras parade rolling, and just a wonderful slate of continuing education speakers at SECO itself. But OIS is something I got exposed to at the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery a number of years ago, and it's always been front and center in my mind because of the ability to bring innovators in eye care technologies and venture capital and doctors and get them all in the same room and really begin to stir those fires and those passions of how can we better provide care to our patients? How can we improve patient outcomes? And so the ability to continue to stay cutting edge and looking at the forefront and looking at the future of what's coming in eye care so that we can do those things and be able to provide that care and you know, continue to be an incubator for ideas and innovations is something that I am just so excited about. And I cannot encourage my colleagues enough to attend OIS at SECO this year. It is going to be something that is unique to optometry. Our profession, to my knowledge, has never had anything like this before that brings those three groups of people together, the innovators, the venture capitalists, and the doctors themselves all in one room, and allows us to interact and learn and share ideas and bounce things off of each other. So I think the potential for this to continue to grow and just be beneficial for everyone involved is just off the charts. So I am just so excited and thrilled that OIS is coming to CECO, and that we're going to be able to build something I think that is really for the future going to expand and just be, it'll be something that's a not miss for sure.
That's excellent. I'm excited as well. And I continue to be amazed at all the innovation that's coming your way. And this conversation just opened my eyes even wider. I hadn't really put two and two together regarding what you're going to be able to see literally in the eye going forward in regards to other disease. So this is a specialty with enormous potential going forward to grow far beyond what it already is, which is amazing. So we really appreciate your help with OIS, and I appreciate your time today sharing your story and your insights in optometry.
Well, Tom, I appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure and a privilege for me to be with you. And as I say, I am so excited about OIS at CECO. So we look forward to seeing everyone there.
Thanks so much. All right. Well, that is a wrap. Chris Roten, thanks so much for joining us. Thank you, OIS podcast listeners, for listening to this conversation. And we hope for joining us at OIS CECO, which is happening on February 21st in New Orleans. Go to OIS.net for more information. While I have your attention, if you could help the podcast by telling your friends and subscribing, that'd be great. If you're looking for content from our OIS at AAO event, it's up on YouTube. Search for OIS colon ophthalmology and you'll find the OIS page. There's a whole playlist there with all the presentations, including Emmett Cunningham's State of the Report. His annual report is on there as well. So lots to see. Go to OIS colon ophthalmology on YouTube and you'll find that page. That's it. Tune in next week. We'll have another great tale of innovation for you on the OIS podcast.